We'll be back late tonight and at headquarters for first shift tomorrow. Any news that cannot wait, leave word for me on Waverly Place, where I will be living for the next while as I finally talked Anna into marrying me. Jack. New York Post. Sunday, May 27, 1883. Morning Edition. Where are Archer Campbell's little boys? Four sons last seen the day before their mother's suspicious death. Police department requesting information from the public. Foul play feared. Readers following the story of the tragic death of Mrs. Janine Campbell last Thursday will be shocked to learn that her four young sons are missing. Archer Campbell, husband of the deceased, a postal inspector and senior detective for the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, last saw his sons, Archer Jr., 5 years old, Stephen, 4 years old, Gregory, 2 years old, and Michael, 2 months old, just the morning before their mother's death. In a statement made to the police, Mr. Campbell related the following facts. Last Tuesday evening, his wife announced that she was taking the children to spend a week on the Connecticut farm of his brother, Harold Campbell, a common occurrence that raised no suspicion. However, when Mr. Campbell came home on Wednesday, he found his wife had collapsed upon return from Connecticut and retired to her bed. She assured him she would be better after a good night's sleep, and took laudanum to that end. She was still abed when he left the next morning for work, and could not be roused, which he attributed to the effects of the laudanum. By 1 o'clock that afternoon, Mrs. Campbell was dead, the victim of suspected malpractice and criminal abortion gone wrong. Mr. Campbell spent Thursday afternoon and all of Friday much occupied with the investigation into his wife's death and the arrangements for her burial. Late Friday evening, he sent a telegram to his brother Harold in Connecticut, announcing the death of his wife, plans for the funeral to take place the next afternoon, and a request that the boys be brought home in order to attend. Early Saturday morning, he received an express telegram from his brother, in which he learned that his boys were not in Connecticut. It had been many months since Janine Campbell or her sons had last visited the Connecticut farm, and even longer since they had had a letter. Harold Campbell knew nothing of the whereabouts of his nephews. Mr. Campbell went immediately to police headquarters to report that his sons were missing. Telegrams to family members as far away as Maine have provided no information or help. All that is known with certainty is that Mrs. Campbell left the city with them last Wednesday morning by train and returned without them later the same day. Police inquiries began on Saturday and will continue until the boys are found and returned to their grieving father. The mayor has directed the police department to spare no effort to locate the Campbell boys. In turn, the police and family ask that any person or persons with information about the boys or about Mrs. Campbell's movements in the days before her death, come forward without delay. Information leading to the safe return of the boys will be amply rewarded. New York Times, Sunday, May 27, 1883. Coroner assembles a jury for the Mrs. Janine Campbell inquest. Distinguished physicians agree to serve. Coroner Hawthorne has called on some of this city's most respected physicians to hear testimony and examine evidence in the case of Janine Campbell's death by criminal abortion. A post-mortem found the cause of death to be infection and blood poisoning following from an illegal operation. The coroner's jury will meet to determine if an unknown party or parties performed the procedure or if Mrs. Campbell operated on herself. If that is so, there will be an inquiry into who provided her with the information and instruments she used. The last two physicians to treat Mrs. Campbell, Dr. Anna Savard and Dr. Sophie Savard, will be present at the inquest with their attorney, Conrad Belmont Esquire, and must be prepared to give testimony to a jury of 6 more experienced experts, as well as an officer of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice. In an unusual twist, Mr. Belmont, attorney for the two lady doctors, approached the coroner to request that the jury include at least two female physicians who, by their sex, experience, and training, would be best able to understand and judge the evidence. This request was denied for reasons of law, custom, and propriety. But the coroner will allow female physicians to be present in Judge Benedict's courtroom, where the inquest will begin at 1 p.m. tomorrow. As is customary, anyone admitted to the gallery may question witnesses. Whether the disappearance of the four Campbell sons will be addressed in the inquest is unclear, though insiders believe that it will be necessary to take the facts of the case into account. They got to the Tottenville train station and onto the train at the very last second. Jack jumped on board with both valises and then hauled Anna and her Gladstone bag up behind him, just as they jerked into motion. The train was crowded, overheated, and awash in tobacco smoke. Anna fell into a seat with a great heaving sigh, lifting her hair off her damp neck. By the time Jack had stowed away the bags and joined her, she was coughing into her handkerchief. They escaped to the covered vestibule between the two cars, where the window had been left open. It meant standing for the entire hour and swaying hard with every jolt, but it was worth any amount of jostling to stand in the cool rush of air. "We're not the only ones with a bright idea." Jack inclined his head to the two women who had appeared at the vestibule door in search of clean air. They squeezed together to make room. They were mother and daughter. Nothing could be more obvious, unless it was the fact that the younger woman was close to giving birth. Mrs. Stillwater and Mrs. Reynolds, as they introduced themselves, on their way to visit friends. Mrs. Reynolds rubbed her great belly with the palm of one hand and could not hide her curiosity. She said, "I think you must be the newlyweds." Her mother's face lit up with interest. "My husband is Joe Reynolds. He's a law clerk. He was one of your witnesses?" Anna had no real memory of the witnesses whom the Justice of the Peace had called into his office, but she nodded. Mrs. Reynolds was saying, "Joe described you. You don't have any way to know this, but Judge Bow refuses to marry almost everybody. He says he won't be a party to a disaster."
"You impressed him," added her mother. "It bodes well for your future. Are you really a doctor?"
Anna agreed that she was. She knew where the conversation would go, and so she started it on her own.
"You are very close to your time, I think."
The younger woman shrugged.
"Everybody says so. But I don't feel so uncomfortable the way most women talk about, except maybe at night when the kicking and thumping keeps me from getting to sleep."
"It's a good time of year to have a baby," Anna offered, because it was true. "Will you stay here on the island?" She felt Jack's attention focus as he realized what she was up to. Anna elbowed him gently to let him know he was not to jump in or offer any comments, and heard him huff his resignation all too clear. In her experience, mothers and daughters had a set way of telling their maternal histories, and she must let it run its course. The mother, born and raised herself on Staten Island, had had all of her children right at home with the help of Meg Quinn, the midwife who had delivered almost everybody on the south end of Staten Island.
"She's only ever lost two children and one mother," the daughter said, "in 30 years of catching babies."
"That's an excellent record," Anna said, and saw them both relax a little.
"We've seen quite a few babies this weekend," Anna went on. "Twins, about 3 months old."
"The Darcy girls," the mother suggested.
"I wouldn't care for twins," her daughter said,
but her nervous smile said she wasn't so sure. Most young women her age did like the idea of twins, but found the reality more than they had imagined or wanted to deal with.
"I heard a very young baby crying when we passed a house on the main street this morning. Mrs. Carruthers first. Poor thing's got the colic, something terrible. And then, yesterday," she paused to look at Jack, Yes? The mother prompted, also turning to Jack, and smiling in a way that made her look more her daughter's age. We were on the beach very near Mount Loretto, he said. We met a family with a very friendly little girl who introduced us to her parents and grandmother and her new baby brother.
That would be Eamon and Helen Mullen, don't you think, Allie? Helen is a good friend of both my daughters. She married the same week as my older girl, my Jess.
They looked very happy, Anna said.
Oh, yes, said Allie Reynolds, her hand returning to rub her belly in gentle circles. But they have had some heartache.
She lowered her voice.
Helen lost her own little boy to a fever when he was just 3 months old. He was gone so quick, they couldn't even send for the doctor. The story went on for a while, mother and daughter reconstructing the death of the Mullins' son.
Then she couldn't catch again, said the daughter.
3 years they tried. It was hard to see her so unhappy.
She seems very satisfied now, Anna said.
That little boy was a blessing, it's true. They adopted him, you know. There's no lack of little Irish orphans in the city, is what we hear. So the new priest arranged for them to get one, and it's made all the difference to the Mullins. Brought them all back to life, you might even say.
The passengers were coming off the ferry just as Jack and Anna left the train station, a small crowd of people on their way to Tottenville. The last person they passed was a priest in a Roman collar, a man in his 50s or more, rotund, with blazing red cheeks and sharp blue eyes. This would be the evasive Father McKinaway, Jack was fairly sure. But there was no time to stop and introduce themselves. It was a conversation that would need careful planning.
Maybe I should write to him again, Anna said when the ferry had begun its trip north on Raritan Bay.
It would be better if I approached him, Jack said. If you can leave that to me once the inquest is over. At least we know the baby is healthy and in good hands.
Yes, Anna said. That's one less thing to worry about. I don't mind admitting my head is spinning.
I'll take that as a compliment, Jack said, slipping an arm around her shoulders. She gave him a half smile.
It will be a very strange honeymoon. I have surgery all tomorrow morning and then in the afternoon.
Her expression was almost blank when she was thinking about the inquest. Out of self-preservation, Jack thought, distancing herself in any way she could in order to better see and understand and analyze. We'll have to be inventive, he whispered against her ear, and she smiled and shivered a little.
Then he saw her attention shift to the empty seat beside her, where an abandoned newspaper fluttered in the breeze. She leaned over to pick it up, and Jack saw the headline, each word like a slash.
4 Campbell sons missing. Inquest into mother's death starts tomorrow. Cap said, You must have that telegram by heart now. How many times have you read it?
I'll keep reading it until they show up at the door and I know it's really true. In fact, Sophie didn't doubt the news at all. But studying the telegram gave her a few moments to think of other things without being observed too closely. A necessary deception, she told herself. Cap was still recovering from Friday, and she had gone to some lengths to see that nothing new was laid before him for as long as humanly possible. If their places were reversed, she would not thank him for such interference, but she was his physician as well as his wife, and as such it was her responsibility. And more than that, she could not bring herself to open up the discussion of the Campbell boys. She could barely stand to think about them at all. And still the image of Janine Campbell as she had last seen her would not be banished. All over the city, people were convincing themselves that she had killed her sons. But Sophie hadn't seen any evidence of psychosis when she saw her just weeks ago. Depression, yes. Anger, too, and despair. But to deliberately set out with the boys to kill them and return home alone,
That required a cold-hearted forethought or a complete break with reality, neither of which she could see. When the door chime came to them, Cap said,
"Go on. I know you can't wait."
She flew across the room and smiled at him from the door as she took off her protective mask.
"I'll bring them straight up."
Anna looked almost burnished, as if she had been buffeted by hard winds off a cold sea and then polished by sunlight. And she was smiling, a sincere smile without artifice. Sophie folded her cousin into her arms and hugged her as hard as she could.
"Ouch," Anna laughed, pulling away. "You never will learn your own strength."
Sophie turned to Jack and hugged him, too, and got no complaints.
"You two," Sophie said, "always up to tricks."
She had tears in her eyes, but she didn't care, and for once Anna didn't seem to mind at all. Her calm, resolute, generally impenetrable expression was gone, for today at least.
"How's Cap?"
Jack wanted to know.
"Fairly calm. Recovering."
It was close enough to the truth.
"He met with Conrad for 2 hours this afternoon, and then I put an end to it. But we can talk about that later."
They started up the stairs, and Sophie noticed the paper tucked under Jack's arm. He caught her gaze and nodded. Sophie said,
"Let's leave that sorry business aside for now, too. Can we do that? He hasn't seen the paper yet."
Anna raised a brow in surprise. "Cap without the Sunday newspapers?
It took some finagling," Sophie admitted. "And now I'm going to insist that we leave everything else aside to celebrate
Anna's capitulation," Jack supplied.
Anna paused on the stair to look over her shoulder and raise her brow at him.
"I'll argue with you about that word later, and I'll look forward to the argument."
It was good to see them bantering and at ease with each other. Sophie wished she could say the same of herself and Cap. He was distant and worried and in pain, and she wanted very badly to get him on the next ship that left New York Harbor. Anna would know all this without being told in explicit terms. No doubt she had spoken to Jack about it. For the moment, though, Anna's attention was focused in a different direction.
"Have you had word from Rose's today?"
she asked.
From his room, Cap called out, "An avalanche of words, one note after the other."
Anna stopped in the doorway to look at him.
"Not about a party, I hope."
Sophie nudged her into the room and took Jack's arm to get him moving too. Then she closed the door behind them.
"Of course," Cap said. "You didn't really think you could talk them out of one, I hope."
Jack said,
"Cap, you look a sight better than the last time I saw you. Marriage agrees with you."
Cap's lopsided grin came and went.
"You have dark circles under your eyes, so I'll assume the same for you."
Sophie let out a squawk of surprised laughter, but Anna just frowned at Cap.
"Marriage hasn't done anything for your manners, but I'm glad to see you nonetheless," Jack said.
"So you're saying we need to be prepared for a surprise party when we get to Rose's?"
Sophie shot Cap an irritated frown, but she should have known he couldn't keep the news to himself.
"You might as well tell us," Anna said. "What is Auntie up to?"
"Never mind about Auntie for the moment," Sophie said. "Let's sit down. I want to hear about this sudden launch into marriage. Every detail, right from the beginning."
The conversation stretched from one side of the room to the other, where Cap sat in strict isolation. Sophie thought she might someday get used to this being close and far at once. If fate was kind, she would have the chance.
Cap said, "If you wanted to get married in a hurry, you needn't go off to Staten Island. You could have done it at City Hall with less fuss." "We didn't go to Staten Island thinking we'd get married," Jack said. "That was just fortunate timing and my good luck."
"They went to talk to the priest about the littlest Russo boy," Sophie reminded Cap. She turned to Anna. No success. We didn't find Father McKinaway, Anna said, and then hesitated, her face turned toward the closed door. What are those voices I'm hearing downstairs?
Sophie shrugged at her apologetically.
You knew Auntie couldn't help herself?
Everybody?
The whole household is here.
Your people too, Cap said to Jack. You never said your father was a giant.
Jack's expression had been calm, almost sleepy, Sophie thought. But his head came around with a jerk.
My people.
Your sisters and your parents, Sophie said. Aunts, uncles, a couple brothers. I didn't catch all the names.
Anna gave a small shake of the head, and then she laughed.
We thought we were so clever, she said. That will show us.
Jack put a hand on her neck and kissed the top of her head.
Between my sisters and your aunt, it was inevitable. None of them has any self-control when it comes to a party.
They love you, Sophie said. We love you, and we're all happy for you.
Cap said,
You'd better go down before they storm the castle. But tell us first about what happened on Staten Island. You didn't find your Father McKinaway, but something happened. I can tell from Anna's expression.
Anna said, We can't talk about this with the Russo girls in the house. Not a word about Father McKinaway or Staten Island. Not today. Maybe not ever.
You found him, Sophie said. You found Vittorio.
Anna nodded, and Jack studied his shoes. Another set of complications, something Sophie hadn't anticipated.
You're right, Cap said. This is a discussion for another day. Go on now. There's a party waiting to get started in the garden. Come back up here when you can, he added. That will be time enough to talk about the inquest and the Campbell boys.
Sophie froze where she stood. From the door, Anna looked back at her. Of course he's read the papers. You know how he is.
She did her best to keep them from me, Cap said. But all she had was Mrs. Harrison helping her, while I had Mr. Vine on my side. And Mr. Vine has a checkered but quite useful past when it comes to smuggling.
In the hall outside Cap's room, Sophie said,
I did try to hide the news from him, or I suppose I was trying to hide it from myself. I can't bear to think about those boys.
Anna put an arm around her shoulder and kissed her cheek. Sophie, I don't mean to be unfeeling, really. I am terribly worried about the Campbell boys, but I'm asking you to put all that aside for just a little while. I'm about to meet my parents-in-law, and I can't think of much else.
Come on, then, Jack said with a resigned smile. Let's put you out of your misery.
I don't even have time to change into better clothes.
Anna mumbled, but she let herself be led downstairs.
We've been outmaneuvered, Jack said, squeezing her hand. Let's surrender with our dignity intact.
The first thing Anna noticed as they walked into the garden was Rosa and Leah, each of them hopping in excitement, their arms full of flowers. They hurtled themselves toward her, and she crouched down, arms spread, to catch them up. She thought,
Your brother is healthy and well, and I'm sorry I can't say even that much to you.
Instead, she hugged them and kissed their cheeks and took the bouquets they thrust at her, fat pink and white peonies so full of scent that she sneezed, and set the whole party to laughing. When she looked up, Aunt Quinlan was there, leaning on her cane. Anna went to her. This small woman is fragile as an iron rod, unflinching and absolute in her love and devotion. She pressed her face to her aunt's and drew in a deep breath. There was nothing to say, because she couldn't put what she was feeling into words.
Come now, her aunt said.
Let me have a look at this husband of yours, and then we'll sit down with your new family.
From the hall windows, Sophie and Cap watched as Anna was drawn into the circle of Jack's family, with his mother at the center and his father as tall and solid as a tree trunk beside her. Jack was very tall, but his father was a half head taller still. Mrs. Mezzanotte was straight and strong, too, a woman sure of herself, with a gaze that was not stern exactly, but missed nothing. Very much like Anna herself. Her two daughters were with her, the quiet and gentle Celestina and Bambina, younger and harder of heart, and two aunts. All of the women stepped forward to draw Anna in while the men of the family looked on.
At least this way she doesn't have to meet the whole family at once, Sophie said.
Most of Anna's new family had stayed behind at Greenwood. Mrs. Mezzanotte had explained the reasoning to Sophie in her excellent English, almost as if she were apologizing for failing to produce every Mezzanotte on the continent. She had said,
"They are all of them unhappy with me, because they wanted to be here to welcome Anna into the family. But my daughters-in-law are a force to be reckoned with, and I put my foot down. I wanted her to myself for this afternoon at least."
For Sophie, it had been an awkward introduction, because Bambina was standing next to her mother, and she had heard more about Bambina than she really cared to know. But the younger Mezzanotte sister had smiled and spoken to Sophie with all good manners. Either she had undergone a change of heart, or she had been threatened with dire consequences. Sophie knew it was most likely the latter. But Mrs. Mezzanotte's kind smile gave her some reason to think that the situation might turn out well. In the garden, Jack's father took Anna by the shoulders, eyes narrowed as if he were examining a botanical specimen. And then he kissed her on each cheek, breaking into a smile so much like Jack's that Sophie found herself laughing.
"I've never seen Anna so nervous," Sophie said, still at the window. "And all for naught. They love her."
"Italians are supposed to be shouting at each other all the time," Cap said. "I thought there would at least be some sparks."
Anna, who was uncomfortable with strangers and never overly demonstrative even with those she loved best, her cousin Anna was being passed from stranger to stranger like a precious but unbreakable treasure. They turned her one way and another to examine her from all sides, touched her face, ran hands over her hair, and she was smiling, answering questions and asking them too, sometimes looking to Jack and sometimes not.
"That man is besotted," Cap said, "and damned lucky too."
His voice wavered, as Sophie knew her own voice might.
"Let's go sit together," she said, "side by side. Can we do that? Just for a little while?"
His hand came to rest lightly on her shoulder, a gentle brushing. Such sadness and resignation in his face. Sophie followed him, listening to the sounds of the party in the garden that would go on, as was right and necessary, without them. Anna pleaded exhaustion and an early start to her Monday, promised long visits and dinners and talks, tours of roses and weeds and the New Amsterdam, and finally, with Jack's help, she was able to extricate herself from the crowd of Mezzanotte's in Cap's garden. She corrected herself, in Cap and Sophie's garden. Rosa and Leah made impassioned pleas to go back with them to Waverly Place, but were distracted very easily by Mrs. Mezzanotte. Anna listened to a very serious discussion in Italian, and remembered what Jack had said about the comfort of hearing your own language in a strange land. In the end, they climbed into a taxi alone. They had never managed to talk to Sophie and Cap about the inquest or about the Campbell boys. Like so many things, it would have to wait. Jack put an arm around her and she leaned into him and hummed,
"I like your parents."
"I hoped you would. It wasn't the way I planned it happening, but there were some advantages to the spontaneous."
"Aunt Quinlan," Anna agreed,
She got hold of them first and paved the way. She does that a lot. She would have made an excellent ambassador.
Did you notice, Leah? Jack said. She wouldn't let go of my father. Margaret didn't seem to mind. She was off in a corner talking to Aunt Philomena.
Everybody was on their best behavior, Anna agreed. But I still feel as if I was run over by an omnibus. Mr. Lee was waiting for them at the house. The minute he took her hands in his, the calm and dignity that Anna had held onto so tightly all afternoon just melted away.
Miss Anna, he said, I wish you and your new husband the very best.
Her voice suddenly hoarse, Anna said, Why, thank you, Mr. Lee. And I almost got through the whole day without tears.
We missed you at the party, Jack said, shaking the hand Mr. Lee extended to him. I wanted to stay behind, be the first one to welcome you both home.
With his free hand, he squeezed Jack's forearm, a fatherly gesture that wasn't lost on Anna.
I expect you've had a long day and would like to retire.
Before Jack turned away, Mr. Lee held up a letter.
For you. Came an hour ago.
Anna raised an eyebrow.
From Oscar, Jack said. It will wait.
Jack had never seen Anna's room before, though he had hinted and sometimes came right out and asked. She had always put him off with a smile. It was a large room, the windows looking out over the garden where the day still burned bright, though it was after 7. Wallpaper too faded to make out a pattern above wainscoting painted white, a gleaming wooden floor covered with small rugs, a bookcase over a desk piled with books and files and papers. Anna stood in the doorway for a long moment, looking nonplussed.
Something wrong?
That's a new bed, she said. And the dresser is new, too, twice the height of my old one.
That's my dresser, Jack said. They must have commandeered the delivery wagons.
I can't believe they managed all this in such a short time. She walked across the room to open a closet door and glanced at him over her shoulder. It's all here, your suits and shirts and your shoes, everything put away tidily. They must have started as soon as they got the telegrams this morning. There were 2 chairs facing each other in front of a small fireplace with a low table between them. A vase of roses sat there on an embroidered cloth that Jack recognized as the work of one of his sisters. Nothing elaborate, but still too much, it seemed.
Are you put out about the changes?
She turned toward him suddenly. Surprised, but not put out. I'm happy that you're here. I am, really. But she stood on the opposite side of the room, on the opposite side of the bed, her hands clasped together at her waist.
Jack said, Come and tell me about these pictures.
Having something to do seemed to relax her. She joined him, but stood a little apart and fixed her attention on the neatly framed photographs and paintings and drawings that were staggered across the full width of the wall over a dressing table. They seemed to be arranged chronologically, the oldest and simplest near the door, a drawing of a couple in their 50s sitting together on a porch. Along the bottom was printed Uphill House 1823, and then a signature, L. Ballantyne. For a few minutes, Jack just studied one picture after another. So many faces, all Anna's people and Sophie's too, because there was a watercolor of a woman who was clearly Indian, standing with a strongly built man who was Indian and African both by his features. Again, the work of L. Ballantyne, Hannah and Ben, Downhill House, 1840. Anna stepped closer to the wall to touch a frame that had been carved with vines and flowers. The portrait was a simple charcoal drawing of another couple, very young and full of life. They sat shoulder to shoulder with a young boy no more than two between them. Before reading the words written along the bottom, he knew that these were Anna's parents and the brother she never spoke of.
Your aunt did all of these drawings and paintings.
She nodded, clearing her throat. Aunt Quinlan's first husband was a Ballantine. She inclined her head toward a small painting, no larger than a hand. The man pictured there was real enough to talk to. Anna nodded to the painting of her parents and brother.
There are other pictures of them, but this is my favorite of all. They seem so alive. Sometimes it's hard to look at them.
You look something like your mother, but I think this, he nodded to the first frame, must be your grandmother, because you are her image exactly.
So they tell me. She was a school teacher, and even so she had great adventures. I never met her.
Jack thought for a moment, wondering if he should have left the portraits for another time. Asking her to talk about the family she had lost when so many other things were pressing on her. She said,
I have an idea. Every night before we go to sleep, I can tell you about the people in one of these portraits. I think that way it will come to me more easily, and you could tell me one of your stories. But now I want to go to bed. I have to leave for the hospital at 5:30 in the morning.
Is it too strange?
I want you here, she interrupted him. I really do want you here.
And it seemed she did. She was more herself as she went about unpacking her valise and putting out clothes for the day, talking to him about everything and nothing. When she went off to have a bath, Jack pulled Oscar's letter out of his pocket.
Jack, since Friday. Item. We managed to nail down all Janine Kemble's movements from Sunday until she arrived at the New Amsterdam, and both Anna and Sophie have solid alibis and witnesses to swear to their whereabouts. If somebody besides the deceased had a hand in the operation, it wasn't either of the doctors Savard. Item. Don't have much to say about the Kemble boys yet.
What there is to tell, I'll do that face to face.
Item. Comstock's men went through the Kemble's place before I could get there, and came away with pamphlets that have got him yelling in the DA's ear. Haven't been able to get close enough to know exactly what he found, but I'm working on it. Item. I've had a tail on Kemble since Friday 3 p.m. Nothing to report there. Item. Belmont thinks that if we can shake loose from Comstock and the damn pamphlets, that will put an end to the whole mess by Tuesday, and the Verhovens can get on the next ship. Item. Comstock is one of the jurors. Belmont did his best to get him thrown off, but no luck so far. I should know more before the hearing starts on Monday. O.M.
When it was his turn, Jack took his time in the bathroom, thinking about Oscar's letter, trying to draw from the words the things he would have read otherwise from the man's face. He gave up, finally, with the realization that the morning would bring a long and difficult day, and they both needed their sleep. And still, the idea of Anna waiting for him in bed made him want her. There was a lock on the bedroom door, and Jack was glad of it, because he didn't intend to sleep in anything but bare skin as he always had. He stripped down while she watched him, stretched out on her side, trying to stay awake. When he got under the covers, she smiled at him sleepily and held out her arms for his kiss, gentle as it was. By the time he had made himself comfortable, the dusk had filled the room, and Anna was asleep. He lay awake for a long time, thinking of the Kemble boys and of Oscar's letter. In the morning, he'd walk with Anna to the New Amsterdam, and they would talk. With that idea in his head, he fell asleep, and dreamed of the sailboats on Raritan Bay, moving farther and farther out of sight. Chapter 26. New York Sun, Monday, May 28, 1883. No trace of missing Kemble boys. Did Janine Kemble suffer from puerperal insanity?
On Tuesday of last week, Mrs. Janine Campbell calmly lied to her husband about her plans for the next day. She told him she was taking their four sons to spend a week with their cousins in the countryside. "Those boys loved it here," Mrs. Harold Campbell, sister-in-law to the deceased, told the son. "They never wanted to go home. All the fresh air and good food and the freedom to play, it breaks my heart to think of them lost, out there in the world, wondering where their mother is and why she left them. Janine can't have been in her right mind." An autopsy determined that Mrs. Campbell underwent an illegal operation sometime on Tuesday or Wednesday, a fact her husband will not credit. Nevertheless, physicians are agreed that she did indeed have an abortion. How she managed to travel out of town is less certain. "She must have been fevered and in terrible pain," said Dr. Hannibal Morgan of Bellevue. "I can only imagine that she dosed herself with opiates." Thus far, detectives have been unable to find anyone who saw Janine Campbell traveling with her boys that Wednesday, but inquiries are still being conducted. By all accounts, Mrs. Campbell was a virtuous woman who kept a spotless home and showered her sons with maternal affection. None of her neighbors have a bad word to say about her. "She was just 3 months out of childbed," noted Dr. Morgan. "This has all the hallmarks of puerperal insanity. In extreme cases, even murder cannot be ruled out."
New York Times, Monday, May 28, 1883. Inquest begins today. Jury of eminent physicians to rule on Campbell death. Coroner Lorenzo Hawthorne has released the names of the jurors who will hear evidence in the inquest into the death of Mrs. Janine Campbell. They are Dr. Morgan Hancock of Women's Hospital, Dr. Manuel Thalberg, lead physician at the German dispensary, Dr. Nicholas Lambert, a forensics specialist at Bellevue, Dr. Abraham Jacoby of Children's Hospital and president of the New York Medical Association, Dr. Josiah Stanton of Women's Hospital, and Dr. Benjamin Quinn, surgeon on the faculty at both Bellevue's School of Medicine and the Women's Medical School. In addition, Anthony Comstock will serve on the jury as a representative of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice. The coroner instructed his clerk to call the inquest to order, and the murmuring in the courtroom trailed off. Sophie took a last look at the notes laid out before her, shuffled them into a pile, and folded her hands in her lap. Beside her, Anna was scribbling already, all her attention on the first of many blank pages she would fill before day's end. The jury would think her inordinately attentive, but Sophie had gone to school with Anna, and she knew better. Her cousin scribbled as she listened, writing down odd words that taken together made little sense. When she got home, she would hand all the closely written pages to Mrs. Lee to use as tinder for the fire. What Anna needed to know, she retained without writing down. She took notes for another reason altogether. As a girl, she had disliked being called on in class and found that most teachers would leave her be if she looked busy. It wasn't that she couldn't answer questions, only that she wanted to decide which ones to answer. Some teachers left her this small vanity, and others did not, but nothing kept her from scribbling. Cap had often stolen her notebook away to read those random words out loud, like an actor on a stage. But they weren't children anymore, and Cap was at home where he belonged, fighting for every breath. She made herself focus on the proceedings. Judge Benedict's courtroom had been made available for the inquest. Given the number of witnesses, the size of the jury, and the overwhelming public interest, Sophie had hoped that Judge Benedict himself would be absent, and was relieved to see that he was. Benedict and Comstock together were a disaster for any woman who came to their combined attention. Because it was an inquest and not a trial, Hawthorne had some latitude in how he ran things. He handpicked the reporters, just three of them, to sit in the back of the courtroom,
and he had spent some part of the morning considering case by case people who applied for permission to sit in the gallery. The ones he turned away were the ones there hoping for scandal, and in particular, news of the missing Campbell boys. The whole city seethed with rumors and supposition about those little boys. They rarely left Sophie's mind. The coroner was saying, "This is an inquest into the death of Mrs. Janine Campbell, nothing more or less. We are here to decide whether her death was the result of malpractice and criminal abortion, and if so, the police will then be responsible for locating the responsible individuals and bringing them into a court of law to be tried. The jury may also rule that Mrs. Campbell died of self-inflicted injuries amounting to suicide. Given the complexities of the case, I have asked physicians to hear the evidence. They are free to ask questions at any time. Persons admitted to the gallery may also ask questions, but should first apply to me."
There were different kinds of evidence, he went on to explain. They would be considering the autopsy and physical items found at the Campbell home, and also they would discuss the deceased's state of mind. He said,
"This is not an inquiry into the whereabouts and fate of the Campbell sons. The subject will come up, but will be kept within bounds. I also want to remind both the jury and those sitting in the gallery that the question of pregnancy is irrelevant. Under the law, it doesn't matter if the deceased was actually with child. The operation itself is illegal in any case. This final point. The chief of police has submitted the results of a preliminary investigation, and on that basis, both Dr. Savard and Dr. Savard-Verhoeven have been cleared of any direct involvement in the illegal operation. They are here because they were the last physicians to treat the deceased, and their testimony will be relevant. However, it has been pointed out to me that one or both of them may or may not be guilty of a different but related crime, that of supplying information and instruments to the deceased that made it possible for her to carry out the operation on herself."
Sophie didn't look at the jury box. She had sworn to herself that she would not, because there was nothing to be gained by it. She knew exactly who had reminded the coroner that dispensing medical advice of certain kinds was illegal, and he was sitting just 15 feet away. Comstock was just a single vote of 7. Of the 6 physicians, 3 could be counted as allies: Abraham Jacoby of Children's Hospital, Manuel Thalberg of the German dispensary, and Dr. Quinn, a Bellevue surgeon who also taught surgery at the women's hospital and had been something of a surly but effective mentor to Anna. The other physicians were known to her only by name and reputation. Dr. Stanton, because he had published article after article attacking women physicians and the New Amsterdam in particular, and Dr. Hancock, because he was one of the surgeons from women's hospital, where women physicians were not welcome or even tolerated. The last physician she knew only as a Dr. Lambert, a specialist in forensics, one with an excellent reputation. With the exception of Thalberg, who worked exclusively among the poor German immigrants, all of the physicians had thriving practices. Some of them, Jacoby in particular, also did a large amount of charity work. But they all lived well. In this group, Comstock looked out of place. The physicians were all carefully groomed and expensively clothed, while Comstock, ponderous and pompous, wore his poorly fitting black wool suit and standard grim expression. But for the whiskers, he always reminded Sophie of an overgrown infant. It was his round face with its flawless complexion and high spots of color where the cheekbones would be, below the layer of fat. She had no intention of studying the man, but it was impossible to ignore the habit he had of sucking his front teeth. Sophie and Anna sat in the foremost row of the gallery, behind the table where the defense would be situated in a real trial, behind them in the second row where Conrad and his clerk, and beyond them, about 2 dozen faces scattered in a room that would have seated many more. Hawthorne might be a businessman with little knowledge of medicine,
But in Sophie's view of things, he had done very well in arranging the inquest. She smiled a greeting at five classmates from Women's Medical School, then got up to greet the three professors who had come as a powerful gesture of support. Mary Putnam Jacoby, Clara Garrison, and Maud Clark. Sophie was especially surprised to see Dr. Garrison, who had so recently been on trial herself, another one of Comstock's favored targets. She was especially glad to see Mary Putnam, who had a mind sharper than any of the men in the room, including her husband, Abraham Jacoby, who sat on the jury. "Steady on," Mary said, and left everything else unsaid. Just as Sophie returned to her seat, the coroner asked the jury to put forward any questions they might have.
"I'd like a clarification." "Dr. Hancock, please go ahead. You've mentioned the possibility that the deceased may have operated on herself in a frame of mind that amounted to suicide. I agree it's something to consider, but if we're going to look at suicide, we are talking about a woman who is suffering from severe mental illness. That discussion will necessarily lead to consideration of the Campbell sons and what happened to them."
Anna stopped scribbling and her gaze fixed on the jury box. Then she wrote something down and turned the writing pad towards Sophie. She was writing with pencil, in sharp, straight strokes that pressed through many layers of paper. In her bag, she'd have another dozen sharpened pencils to replace the one in hand when it got too dull. She had written, "Morgan Hancock, Women's Hospital." Sophie nodded. "Studied with Czerny." Sophie nodded again.
"I didn't forbid the subject," the coroner was saying, "but I would like to keep in mind that our primary purpose is something else entirely."
The coroner said,
"We'll start with Dr. Graham of the ambulance service."
Anna was aware of Jack at the back of the room. He stood there with Oscar Maroney and another detective, his arms crossed and his chin lowered to his chest, as he listened to Neil Graham recount what had happened the previous Thursday. Graham was a good witness, clear and focused. The jurors asked questions, some of them very pointed, but Neil Graham didn't fluster.
"How many abdominal surgeries have you observed?"
Abraham Jacoby's tone was neither kind nor confrontational.
"Mrs. Campbell's case was the 33rd. And your impressions of Dr. Savard's performance?"
He faltered then and glanced in Anna's direction. She focused on her writing pad, where she wrote 33rd and impressions of. Abraham Jacoby was asking questions he knew the answers to reestablish her credentials. He was subtle as ever in his support and therefore very effective.
"I'm not asking you for a detailed critique," said Jacoby. "Just your impression."
Graham didn't hesitate any further.
"She was confident. She moved quickly, but not hastily, and she told me what she was doing and pointed out what she was seeing. I learned quite a bit in that short period of time."
Benjamin Quinn cleared his throat.
"And what was it you learned?" "I thought I was pretty good at thinking on my feet, but I have a long way to go."
Anna wrote, "a long way to go." Conrad Belmont leaned forward and put a hand on her shoulder to whisper,
"He said not one thing to contradict your testimony."
"Of course he didn't," Anna whispered back, irritably. Conrad patted her as if she needed encouragement, and she resisted the urge to pull away. New York Post, Monday, May 28th, 1883. Campbell inquest begins. A neighbor's concerns for the missing boys. Suicide mentioned for the first time. The deceased's husband to testify tomorrow. Coroner Lorenzo Hawthorne began the inquest into the death of Mrs. Janine Campbell today by presenting seven prominent and educated men with a long list of admonishments about their responsibilities as jurors.
A short discussion of the possibility of suicide, insanity, and the relevance of the Campbell son's disappearance was left unresolved. But it was the coroner himself who first raised the subject with one of the witnesses. The first witness was Dr. Neil Graham, an intern at Bellevue who works part-time for the police ambulance service. Despite pointed questions from the jury, Dr. Graham had only praise for Dr. Anna Savard, the surgeon who tried to save Mrs. Campbell's life. The day's second witness provided compelling testimony and insight into the life and death of Mrs. Campbell. We provide it here in fulfillment of our pledge to bring all the facts of this disturbing case to our readers. Inquest testimony. Mrs. Mabel Stone, housewife, resident at 24 Charles Street, appears before Coroner Hawthorne's jury and makes the following statement. Coroner, please start by explaining how you knew the deceased. Mrs. Stone.
The Campbells are our neighbors and have been since they were first married 7 years this summer.
Coroner, you considered her a friend? Mrs. Stone.
I did. Janine Campbell was a no-nonsense kind of person, which I am myself. We saw eye to eye.
Coroner, did you see her often? Mrs. Stone.
Janine had her hands full from dawn till dusk with those little boys and the house. I myself have no children, but have always felt the lack, and so I lent a hand whenever I could. I saw her every day, just about, except Sundays.
Coroner. And now, if you could tell us about last week.
Mrs. Stone. Early last Wednesday, I went by train to visit my sister in Albany. I was back Thursday morning, and I noticed how quiet it was at the Campbells, and so I went over to say hello. There was no answer when I knocked. So I went around back to see was she hanging out laundry, but she wasn't. So I looked in the kitchen window.
Coroner. Is this common practice in the neighborhood?
Mrs. Stone. It's common enough between friendly families. So as I was saying, I looked in the kitchen window, and there she was.
Coroner. This is difficult, I understand, Mrs. Stone. But please be specific. Exactly what did you see?
Mrs. Stone. I saw Janine, Mrs. Campbell, lying on the floor in a pool of blood.
Coroner. And then?
Mrs. Stone. Well, I went in, of course, like anybody would. At first I thought she was dead, she was so pale. But when I lifted up her head, she opened her eyes. Easy now, says I to her, I'll send for a doctor. But she said no, she didn't want me to.
Coroner, was she in pain?
Mrs. Stone, yes, sir, in terrible pain, curled up tight with her knees to her chest, hardly able to talk. But she didn't want a doctor, and she said so. Asked me to help her into bed so she could sleep. And I says to her, Janine, you are bleeding to beat the band. You're having a miscarriage, and you need a doctor.
Coroner, how did you know she was having a miscarriage?
Mrs. Stone, only a man would ask such a question. You don't get to be my age without seeing miscarriages and worse. Why, I'd seen Janine herself miscarry twice before. Nearly bled to death the second time, but Mr. Campbell was home. He got the doctor to come, and late the next day she was out of bed and back to work. She didn't have much choice.
Coroner, these are things you witnessed yourself.
Mrs. Stone, yes, and I saw the doctor come. That gentleman right there.
Coroner, let the record reflect that the witness is pointing to Dr. Heath in the gallery. Go on, Mrs. Stone.
Mrs. Stone, as I say, I seen Mrs. Campbell in such a state before, so I knew why she was bleeding. But this time was far worse than the other two, so I says to her again, I have to send for an ambulance. And she says, no, just leave me here. Archer will find me when he gets home.
Coroner, those were her exact words.
Mrs. Stone, exact. But I ran outside and saw the baker's boy, and I told him to run as fast as he could to the Jefferson Market police station, just 3 blocks away, and tell them we needed an ambulance.
And he did.
Coroner. Where were the Campbell children while all this was going on?
Mrs. Stone. I don't know. I just don't know. At the time, I barely noticed they were gone except to think to myself, I do remember this. Thank the Lord they don't have to see their mam in such a state. But I didn't ask her. That was my mistake.
Coroner. It wasn't unusual for the boys to be away from home.
Mrs. Stone. It happened maybe 3 times a year that she sent them off to stay with relatives. Usually it was to Mr. Campbell's brother, the one with the farm in Connecticut, but sometimes to another brother in New Haven. She sent them away when it was time to do the spring cleaning, usually, because they were too little to help and slowed her down. One thing she never had enough of was time.
Coroner. Mrs. Campbell didn't mention her sons to you while you waited for the ambulance?
Mrs. Stone. Not a word. She fell away into a faint and didn't rouse again until the young doctor, Dr. Graham, who spoke before me just now, came, not a quarter hour after I sent the boy running. He made me go out while he examined her, but I heard her scream loud, and then she was saying she didn't want an ambulance. But he called for the stretcher anyway, as was proper. When they took her out of the house, she grabbed my hand and said, "Send word to Mr. Campbell now, Mabel, would you? Tell him he'll find me at the New Amsterdam." And those are the last words I heard her say. Out she went into the ambulance, and then she was gone. I hardly knew what to do with myself, I was that agitated. So I cleaned the floors. There was a terrible lot of blood, you see, and I took the bedding away to soak. Next I knew, Mr. Campbell was at my door, telling me his wife was dead.
Clerk. There is a question from the gallery.
Coroner. So I see. Dr. Heath was once Mrs. Campbell's physician of record. Please go ahead, doctor.
Dr. Heath.
I am Dr. Heath. Did Mrs. Campbell ever mention me to you?
Mrs. Stone. No.
Dr. Heath.
She never said she had gone to see Dr. Heath at Women's Hospital.
Mrs. Stone.
No, she did not.
Dr. Heath.
Did she mention any other doctor or nurse or midwife?
Mrs. Stone.
No.
Dr. Heath.
Never said a word about her health.
Mrs. Stone.
That's a different question altogether. We talked from time to time about such things, as women do.
Dr. Heath.
And in all those conversations, she never mentioned a doctor's name?
Mrs. Stone.
Doctor, you'll forgive me for my blunt nature, but I doubt Mrs. Campbell ever gave you a thought. She was up to her ears in work, dawn till dark and beyond. When she took 10 minutes for herself to sit down with a neighbor to have a cup of tea, you were the last thing on her mind.
Coroner.
We're off the subject. Mrs. Stone, just 2 more questions. When we spoke to Dr. Graham of the ambulance service, he told us that Mrs. Campbell specifically requested she be delivered into Dr. Savard's care at the New Amsterdam. Did she mention Dr. Savard to you before the ambulance arrived?
Mrs. Stone.
She did not.
Coroner.
This is the last matter we need to raise. Mrs. Stone. Did Mrs. Campbell ever talk to you about abortion?
Mrs. Stone.
Janine Campbell was a good Christian woman, sir. Mr. Campbell wasn't the easiest of husbands, but she persevered as a woman must. She obeyed and kept house and raised those boys to be polite and helpful, and made sure that dinner wasn't a single minute late and her husband's coffee was exactly the way he liked it. And when her health failed her, she bore up under that, too. She wasn't a complainer. She never spent a day in bed except when she was new delivered.
Coroner.
We have another question from someone in the gallery. Dr. Garrison, is it?
Dr. Clara Garrison.
Mrs. Stone, I'm a physician and a professor at Women's Medical School. May I ask, did you ever notice any signs of instability in Mrs. Campbell? Some of the questions before the coroner's jury have to do with her state of mind and her sanity. You saw her almost every day, as I understand it. Would you have an opinion on this?
Mrs. Stone.
Hard work never killed anybody. That's what my ma'am used to say.
but it can grind a woman down to dust. Janine was tired and her spirits were low, but I never heard her talk crazy or do anything but what she always did, housework and tending to the boys. She was a good mother, too, and her boys adored her. Some women take things out on their children, but Janine handled them different. She could get what she wanted with a soft word. And that's the way she was. She worked hard, day in and day out, and she looked after those boys.
Coroner, this is very difficult, I understand. Take a moment to gather your thoughts.
Mrs. Stone.
She said to me once that her own father was too eager with the rod, and that she wanted something else for her boys. She didn't have an easy life, and she swallowed down more than her fair share of bile, but was no more insane than I am or you are, Dr. Garrison.
Coroner. Thank you, Mrs. Stone. You're excused.
On the way home from the inquest Monday evening, Anna went over the long list of things she needed to do, all of which involved other people. Aunt Quinlan and Mrs. Lee would want to hear about Staten Island and about the inquest. Jack's parents would be expecting them to call after supper, and once there, his sisters would raise the subject of the new house. Anna was curious, she could admit to herself, about Jack's mother. It was odd to look forward to and dread something at the same time. But what she found oddest of all was this idea of herself as daughter-in-law. As someone with parents, when for all these years she had been without. Anna realized that she had always assumed she wouldn't marry, specifically because she had trouble imagining herself with a family that included parents and brothers and sisters. And now she had all of that. But what she wanted to do was slip between cool sheets and fall asleep in a breeze from an open window. She wanted to sleep for days on end, and to wake up when the whole sorry business of the inquest and the missing boys had been resolved. She wanted to sleep in order to put Mrs. Stone's testimony out of her head, and at the same time, she wanted to bind all those words together into a club and hit every man in the room over the head with it. Because they hadn't really understood the story behind the story, and what Mrs. Stone was trying to tell them about Janine Campbell's life. Mrs. Stone had called herself plain-speaking and blunt, but she had wrapped every observation in the language of well-brought-up women, with the result that none of the men had any real sense of the anger and frustration that drove Janine Campbell. She wanted to sleep, and she wanted Jack sleeping beside her. Instead, she had to resign herself to an evening of talking, one that started over supper. Then Sophie joined them, and Anna felt much better. She had come especially to hear about Vittorio Russo, something Jack's parents made possible when they took the little girls off to be fed by his Aunt Filomena and coddled by a house full of mezzanottes.
"And to speak Italian," Mrs. Mezzanotte had explained. "They miss the language."
For once, Margaret didn't seem to mind letting them go off without her, but then she wanted to hear about the youngest mezzanotte boy as well. Jack told the story in a very ordered, very complete manner that struck Anna as unlike him, until she realized that this was how he presented a case to his superiors, the man who judged his performance and made decisions about his career. It was a change from the way stories were usually told around Aunt Quinlan's table, but then it was a serious subject.
"He's a beautiful child," Anna said when he had finished. "Dearly loved. The picture of rude good health."
At the startled look on Jack's face, Aunt Quinlan laughed.
"A family turn of phrase," she said. Sophie's great-grandmother used it for children who were thriving and content.
"Then it fits in his case," Jack said.
He turned to Margaret, who had been silent throughout the story.
"You've spent more time with the girls than anybody. Do you have any thoughts on how to proceed?"
She took a moment to pat her mouth dry with her napkin,
and then she cleared her throat. Margaret appreciated good manners and respectful gestures, and Jack gave her both. In return, she answered with more candor than Anna would have anticipated.
I do have an opinion, she said, but I'm afraid I'll offend you as a Catholic.
Jack said, I'm not Catholic. I was never baptized, but that's a longer story for another time. Go on and say what you're thinking.
Margaret studied him for a moment. Anna could read her expression very easily. She was fighting the urge to ask him for details. Margaret needed to put him in a box marked Lutheran or Protestant or Baptist. It would never occur to her that he might be something other than Christian. But Jack respected her opinion in the matter of the Russo children, and so she restrained her curiosity.
From everything I've read about the Church of Rome, I can't imagine that they'd allow a child to be taken away from a good Catholic home to be brought up in such an unconventional household as this one. It could take months or years and might even go to court, and that without much hope of success. Worst of all, the girls will have to live through it all. They are just starting to really come into their own, but this would set them back. The knowledge that their brother is nearby but cut off from them would be more than Rosa could cope with.
Sophie said, There's also the boy himself and the family to think about. We might well do more harm than good in the greater scheme of things.
This morning, getting ready for the day on one side of the room while Jack dressed on the other, Anna had hoped that going back to work would be distraction enough to keep her mind off Vittorio, but the image of him in his adoptive mother's arms stayed with her while she saw patients and met with her assistants and students and answered mail. Even in Judge Benedict's courtroom, her thoughts kept wandering back to Staten Island, and not to the good things, the excellent things that had transpired, but to the little boy who was no longer lost, and still not yet found. She said,
I promised Rosa I would try.
You have tried, her aunt said. Are you feeling guilty?
Anna felt Jack's gaze on her, waiting, patient.
Not guilty exactly, but to make myself feel better, I would have to cause a lot of other people great distress. I'm not so self-centered as that.
Aunt Quinlan nodded, pleased with her. Jack said,
I'll approach Father McKinnaway, just to be sure of what we think we know, and in the meantime,
he paused, and Anna could almost see the question hovering there, unspoken. What will you do with the boy if you get him?
I won't be here to deal with the results of your decision, Sophie said, as if Jack had spoken out loud. But I will be back, and I will do whatever needs to be done. I would gladly take on all three children if it comes to that.
You'd give up your profession?
Margaret's tone was unapologetically doubtful.
I don't know, Sophie said, but it's a possibility.
Anna didn't like that idea at all, but she understood, too, that Sophie would want something to come home to when Cap was gone. She wondered if her cousin was even aware of this herself. When Jack announced that he would see Sophie home and then spend a little time with his parents, Anna was so happy to go off to bed that she could barely contain herself. She kissed him goodbye in the front hall and tried to think of something to say. Be quick, be careful, hurry home, must you go? None of those things would come out of her mouth.
Married barely 2 days and you're eager to get rid of me.
She was relieved and surprised both by the way he was smiling at her.
Savard, you need a little time to yourself. I'm not offended. I'll try not to wake you when I come in.
Anna went to bed and slept. As they got into Cap's carriage, Sophie's carriage now, Jack reminded himself, a police runner dashed up and handed him an envelope. He put it away in his pocket without looking at it, but she had not missed the exchange. From Oscar, he explained. It can wait. Which wasn't exactly true, but he would act as if it were. Sophie looked distracted, and he was fairly sure he knew why. Still, he waited for her to ask.
Do you know anything about the Campbell boys that isn't in the newspapers?
He shook his head. She didn't believe him, he could see it. But why should she? Men lied to women all the time and called it protection or concern for their sensibilities, when really what they wanted was an end to the questioning.
I would like to hear the truth, she said, no matter what it is.
He inclined his head. That's good to know. The truth is, I don't have any information that isn't in the papers at this moment, and if and when I do, I will share that information with you, no matter how distressing.
Satisfied, Sophie sat back. She said, What do you think should happen with Vittorio? This was a question Jack could answer without hesitation.
I think he should stay where he is.
Does Anna know you feel that way?
No, but then she hasn't asked me directly. If she does, I won't lie to her.
She isn't sure herself what would be best.
Yes, she is, Jack said, but she's not ready to acknowledge it.
You do understand her, Sophie said. I'm glad.
Don't congratulate me yet, Jack said. I'm sure to fall on my face sooner or later.
You'll pick yourself back up. And let me tell you a secret about Anna. She doesn't hold a grudge, at least not with people she loves.
At home, at what used to be home, Jack spent a half hour being peppered with questions, some of which he answered, many of which he ignored. It was a familiar dance with his mother. He ignored a question. She stepped away and then swung around to approach it from another direction.
I like her, his mother said. You know that I like her.
I know that you wouldn't hesitate to tell me if you didn't, Jack said, married or not. His father barked a short laugh, then went back to his newspaper. In the kitchen there was sudden silence, because his sisters were listening, which meant that the little girls were listening too, something his mother was well aware of. But we are married, he went on, for better or worse. Some of the tension in her face retreated. Mama, he said then, she'll never be a housewife. Not even when we have a family. That got him a smile.
She wants a family.
Yes, Jack said, though I don't know why you would mind if she didn't. You've got too many grandchildren to keep track of as it is.
Never too many grandchildren,
his father said from behind the pages of Il Giornale.
Never, his mother echoed. Jack stood up.
My work here is done.
We still have things to discuss, his mother said. But go back to your bride.
Instead, he went to the station house and took the time at the duty desk to write a note and arranged for it to be delivered to Anna at home. Called into the station house. Maybe very late, but I'll be there to walk you to work in the morning. Ever yours, J.M. Upstairs, Oscar was leaning back in his chair, his feet crossed at the ankle and one heel propped on the edge of the desk. It was how he did his best thinking, but it was also how he napped. Sometimes it was hard to tell the difference. In either case, Jack didn't see the need to disturb him straight away, so he sat down to the pile of paperwork that had appeared on his own desk. Arrest reports, most of it. He had been reading for a few minutes when Oscar said,
You leave for 3 days and I get stuck with 2 homicides, 3 assaults, and pulling Baldy out of trouble, yet again.
Anna has rechristened him Ned, Jack said. He's in the tombs, I take it.
I'll let him go tomorrow. No real evidence, but I thought he needed a night to cool off.
Your note said he pulled a knife.
Which disappeared.
Jack whistled under his breath.
Where was this?
Outside the Black and Tan. He went looking for one of the younger boys and found him exactly where he didn't want to find him. He got ugly.
As it always does.
Oscar nodded and pulled his hat back down over his eyes. He was an excellent detective, but not overly hampered by the letter of the law. Jack wondered if he should tell Anna about this newest situation with Baldy, and decided that the matter could wait. He needed to talk to Oscar about the Campbell boys. But instead, Jack turned his attention to the paperwork and waited for his partner to rouse himself for the next conversation. If he submitted the arrest reports as they stood, the whole pile would end up back here on Jack's desk, because nobody else could make out Maroney's handwriting. He picked up a pen and uncorked an ink bottle. Oscar's feet hit the floor with a thump.
So what happened with McKinaway?
Jack put the cork back in the ink bottle and told him about Mount Loretto and Vittorio Russo. He watched as Oscar's expression shifted from weariness to surprise.
I'll be damned, he said. You did it. You found the baby.
I'm just as surprised as you are. But it's far from settled, and there's still the older boy.
Now, are you going to tell me about the Campbell case?
Oscar said.
I'm hungry.
He got up and walked out of the office, fitting his hat to his head as he went. Jack followed him, raising a hand in greeting to a couple of other detectives bent over paperwork on the other side of the room. He wasn't sure if his getting married was general knowledge yet, but he didn't want to find out at the moment. By the time he got downstairs, Oscar had already disappeared down the hallway that led to the rear exit. Jack found his partner in the corner booth at McNeil's, with a cup of coffee in front of him. The only door into the diner was in the alley behind police headquarters, which was why every man he'd ever seen in the place either had a badge now or had had one in the past. McNeil himself had been a cop about 100 years ago, before he lost a leg at Spotsylvania. Now he stumped around the diner's kitchen, shouting at everybody, good mood or bad. He worked the night shift alone, and his sons took the day shift. Jack paused at the counter to get the cup of coffee the old man poured for him. Took a couple of minutes to be shouted at about the follies of marriage, and then slid into a booth across from Oscar.
Any luck tracing Mrs. Campbell's movements?
McNeil thumped a plate of eggs and bacon down, so Jack sat back to wait while Oscar ate. At the halfway mark, he wiped his mouth and started to talk.
You know what Grand Central's like. I talked to every ticket seller, flower girl, boot black, and baggage man that I could find who was working the depot that day. A few think they saw her there with the boys, but nobody's sure. I'm thinking now they traveled some other road.
A steamer?
I looked into that. Don't seem likely. Not for somebody watching her pennies.
They were quiet while Oscar finished his plate. He had a dainty way of going about it for a big man with an appetite, something Jack hadn't figured out until he had known the man a good 6 months. Maroney was vain about his mustache and lived in fear of getting food caught up in it. He ate the last of his bacon, crossed his knife and fork over the plate, and leaned back in the booth, trying to look casual, as he ran one knuckle over the brush on his upper lip. Jack hid his face in his coffee cup for as long as it took to get rid of a smile.
What are you thinking? He asked finally.
Well, I don't think she drowned them. That's the rumor, you know. She went to the shore to toss those boys in the drink.
Jack hadn't been around long enough to catch up on the gossip, but it made sense that people would be anticipating the worst. A rumor was like an army on the march, no stopping it.
But the timing just doesn't work out, Oscar went on. She was home when Campbell came in from work on Wednesday. Don't see how you could drown four boys and come away looking like nothing fails you. And then there's what the stone woman had to say, that business about her husband finding her when he got home.
Hawthorne didn't seem to take any note of that, Jack said.
That's because he owns a string of lumber mills and doesn't know what he's doing, questioning somebody on the stand. Boston went ahead and got rid of the coroner system. You'd think we could do the same.
Jack had had the exact same thought, listening to Hawthorne question Mrs. Stone. He might be well-meaning and thoughtful, but he was also uninformed and untrained. If Janine Campbell had said, "Archer will find me when he gets home," then that was as good as a confession. She knew she was dying, and she wanted her husband to find her dead. A lawyer would have homed in on that and asked Mrs. Stone a dozen more questions, trying to get her to clarify the deceased's state of mind. Oscar said,
"She figured it was less troubling killing herself than it would have been to kill him. So I'm wondering, if she was that angry, maybe she did find a way to kill the boys."
"I don't think so," Jack said. "She knew she was dying, sure. What she wanted was not to leave the boys to their father's tender mercies. He looks like a hard case to me."
Oscar nodded.
"Worse, he looks like a closet hard case. One who uses his fists behind closed doors. They didn't say anything about bruises on the autopsy, though."
"Wouldn't be the first time a body turned up dead with no marks to show how it got that way."
Oscar swallowed the rest of his coffee.
"So she stowed the boys away somewhere. Is that what you're thinking?"
Jack lifted a shoulder.
"They could be anywhere by now. Canada comes to mind. She was from Maine."
Jack nodded.
"I suppose we could get in touch with the Bangor coppers, but it's a big state."
"Well," Oscar reached for his hat, "tomorrow's another day, as they say, so clever and all. And there's other things to be thinking about. First and most important, you've got to be back here at 6:30 to start your shift, and you've left your new bride all alone, just 3 days married."
2 days, Jack said, "and 5 hours.
He rarely flushed, but now color ran up his throat to his face. Oscar laughed and slapped him on the back. He slipped into bed quietly, drawn into the nest of often washed linen sheets that smelled of sunshine and lavender and Anna. His Anna, her cheeks flushed with sleep, on her side so that he could study her face in the vague soft light of the lamp before he put it out. One part of him wanted to wake her, but she had earned her rest. There would be more nights and mornings and middays too, when they'd have privacy and time enough. He'd made sure of it.
Chapter 27. Tuesday morning near the end of May might have been July by the weather. Later in the summer, Anna would keep an extra set of clothes in her office. But today she was faced with a choice. She could take the noon hour to try to catch up with her paperwork, in which case she'd show up at the inquest wilted and damp with sweat. Or she could go home and change. She went home and found Aunt Quinlan alone in the parlor, smiling as if Anna's arrival were the only thing in the world she had ever wished for. In return, Anna might have started to cry. Things had happened so quickly, and she had let herself be drawn along without taking time for her aunt.
"Get changed quickly," Auntie said, "and I'll arrange things down here."
By the time she got back, Mrs. Lee had put out a plate of sandwiches and a pot of tea and disappeared back into the kitchen. Anna just sat beside her aunt and gently picked up one of her hands. They were very delicate, as if the bones had gone as hollow as a bird's. The skin was soft and shiny and speckled with age spots.
"You've been using the wax bath for your joints," Anna said. I hope it helps with the pain.
It does, her aunt said. The heat is wonderful. And the teas, they help too.
But not enough, Anna knew. This woman who had spent all her life doing things with her hands would sit just as she was for whatever time was left to her. I can remember you painting, Anna said. You handled the paintbrush like I handle a scalpel. I was little, but I remember.
You were 7 when I stopped.
Anna nodded. When you were working, I had the idea that you were painting a window I could walk through if I tried.
Her aunt smiled. Very fanciful for such a serious young mind. You were so quiet, sitting in the corner, I often forgot you were there. Of course, that was before Sophie.
Anna remembered what it had felt like to be alone. I love Sophie and Cap, Anna said, and I wouldn't change a thing, but sometimes it's nice to have you to myself.
So, Aunt Quinlan said, here we are by ourselves. You married Jack Mezzanotte.
Anna laughed. Yes, I did, although sometimes it all feels unreal. Was it like that when you got married? Her aunt's expression was thoughtful. After a moment, she said,
you know that your Aunt Hannah's people believe that the dead are never far away. She told me once, and this was before she met Ben, that her first husband and little boy sometimes came from the Shadowlands to talk to her. Some people dislike that idea because it frightens them. But when Simon died, I waited and waited. I wanted him to come back to talk to me, in my dreams at least. I wanted to scold him for being so reckless on the ice floes the day he died. And he did come, finally. But by that time, I wasn't angry at him anymore. I just missed him. He still comes now and then, and when he does, he looks as he did when we were young. Sometimes he has our littlest 3 girls with him, the ones we lost too soon.
And Nathaniel?
Aunt Quinlan talked sometimes about her son, the last of 6 and the only boy. Nathaniel Ballantyne had died at Shiloh on his 25th birthday, unmarried, childless. Nathaniel, most of all, her aunt said. He knew how angry I was about him going off to fight. He's been trying to make it up to me ever since. Sometimes he is as real to me as you are, sitting there. She shook herself a little. Enough of that. There was something I wanted to tell you, and you let me wander off.
Anna tried to prepare her mind, but Aunt Quinlan's stories were never predictable.
As a little girl, you already knew what it meant to lose the people you love, and that made you shy. Then the war came along, and we lost Paul and Harrison, and made it 10 times worse. When you and Cap got to be friends, I thought, maybe he'll pull her out of it. And he did. A good ways, he brought you back to being brave enough to face the world. Sophie brought you along even further. But it's there in you still. The need to hide away.
Anna had heard this before, and she knew that it was at least in part true. So you're saying Jack is going to change my view of things? Aunt Quinlan looked at her with an expression that was pure surprise.
That would be a silly thing to say, Anna. You know as well as I do that people rarely change once they reach a certain age. What I'm saying is, you're a turned inward soul. It's the way you cope with the hard things in life. You hide away.
You think Jack doesn't realize that about me?
Maybe he does, her aunt said. But if he does, it's only in his mind. He doesn't know what it will